Hey, we're kicking off a new week here on The Schilling Show, and it's always good to have David Murata in studio, president of Murata Wealth Management. Today, which retirement accounts to fund? He's online at muratahonmoney.com. And do you agree with my contention, David, that really this is kind of a game that you play with taxes, and you have to be able to try to outsmart the government?
It is. It's a huge strategy game. Sometimes you need to look 30 years ahead in order to tell where, you know, just like in chess, you need to look 10 moves ahead. One way of thinking about it is that the government, it's like the government is taxing dance moves, and it's taxing the most common dance moves. So you just need to learn some new dance moves and not do what everybody else is doing, because the government has rigged the system so that it collects the most amount of tax with the least amount of thinking. And so you can outsmart them. You can at least keep a little bit more of your hard-earned money, and you can know that your future self might be subject to great taxes simply because you're doing the most common dance moves today.
You know what I hear all the time that really bugs me a lot is this condemnation of individuals and corporations that are, quote-unquote, dodging taxes by holding their money overseas. As long as they're within the rule of law, I have no problem with that. In fact, I applaud it because it means less money to the government and more money to hire people, to invent new things, to increase entrepreneurship and stimulate the economy. And yet that has somehow become evil.
Yeah, the tax burden is like having sand in your engine. And avoiding taxes is like having an engine cleaning and having greasing your engine and having lubricating your engine. So it just makes sense that the more efficient that you can make the entrepreneurial effort, then the more money there'll be for society as a whole. And everyone complains that the rich are getting richer and the poor are not. And the truth of the matter is that the poor will always be zero. If you spend every dime you make and you never save anything, your account will be zero. And we will always have, 40% of the world that lives hand to mouth and spends everything they make. And it's not a question of how much they make. It's not that they don't make enough. There are people making, $100,000, $200,000 that I know that have absolutely no savings because they just don't save anything. Savings is not important to them. So the fact that the gap continues to get wider and wider simply means that the more productive people who save are doing better and society as a whole is doing better. And that's a testament to the economics of the free markets, that we can have a society that can increasingly have a greater and greater number of people who are getting welfare, which is a upper middle class in the rest of the world. And it's simply because we're free and we have a tremendous largesse that we can have the social programs that we have.
You know, it's interesting that you bring this up. I had a conversation not long ago with Don Watkins of the Ayn Rand Institute, who was talking about people fretting over this disparity, and that the assumption is there's a fixed pie here, and that, if someone's taking all of this pie, that there's less left for you and for me, and so therefore we ought to be mad at them and stop them from doing this. But what he said is that human beings, unlike animals, are creative individuals. In other words, we create things out of nothing. Animals have to survive on whatever is out there, but humans can create things, and therefore it's not a fixed pie, and someone else having more doesn't necessarily mean that you're having less.
It's not. Unfortunately, our animal minds still get very, very greedy about if somebody else has more pie than we do. It doesn't matter if we have more pie than we can eat. If someone else has more pie than we have, we get very upset about it. And studies after studies have shown that that people would rather have $100 and everyone else have $100 than they get $200 but somebody else gets $500.
And I see this with my kids, particularly my daughters, who compete with each other. So, as soon as there's a Pop-Tart put down on one daughter's plate, even though the other one has one with only one bite out of it, it's a different flavor. Now I want that one because the other one has it. I was just fine before it got put on her plate.
We are hardwired for envy. And envy is, I think, almost worse than greed. Because greed, at least you're just trying to strive. And so long as you work really hard and try to get lots of stuff, then at least greed is the self-interest that you want to have as nice things as you can get. Envy is more insidious, though, because it's I don't want you to have nice things if I can't have them. And so I actually think that I would rather have people who are trying to better themselves than people who are trying to worsen others.
We're talking with David Morata on retirement accounts, which ones you should fund. So in the first segment here, I want to look at the process itself and understand how this came to be like it is. And then I want to get into some of the specifics of the various accounts. So let's help people understand how this works.
Yeah, so the government has legislated all kinds of different accounts. When we set up a husband and wife, sometimes there are 20 different accounts that they might have in all of their different finances. And so you could have a 401k or a 403b or a traditional 401k or a Roth 401k or a Roth IRA or a SEP IRA or an HSA or a 529 account. And there are just so many different kinds of accounts that you can use as investment vehicles. And the reason that all of these accounts exist is because the government taxes capital gains. It doesn't matter if most of capital gains is simply inflation. The government taxes capital gains, and that taxing of capital gains and dividends and interest makes all of these different accounts and rules important to you, because the headwind of having to pay taxes on nothing but inflation is a huge headwind. And there is a level of inflation such that the government could bankrupt everyone in America simply by having this huge inflation and then taxing everybody based on that inflation, and they could actually take more money than you've earned that way. So because of that, all of these different kinds of accounts matter, and when you can put money in and how much money you can put money in and when you can take money out and when it's taxable if you take money out and when it's not taxable if you take money out are all rules that are part of the game. And if you don't understand the rules, then you're liable to do the two kinds of accounts that are the most common and the most tax inefficient. You're liable to fund your traditional 401k, and you're liable to save money in a taxable account. And that's what most people do, and that's the two least tax efficient methods of saving money.
You know, you talk about the concept of inflation and being taxed on inflation. It's quite a racket the government has. Whatever happened to indexing? Now, this is something that we've heard in the past, and I think it even has a couple of applications, but shouldn't we be indexing all taxation across the board for inflation?
Yes, and if we indexed capital gains for inflation, the difficulty is the calculations would be pretty difficult, but the good news is you would save a tremendous amount on your taxes for capital gains taxes.
Let's also talk about the social engineering aspect of all of this, because you mentioned the government putting these things forward, these opportunities for people to, you know, put money aside in little pots for various things. Obviously, it would be a lot simpler if you could just do one and have, you know, all of them combined, but you can't. To what extent is this social engineering?
Well, they're trying to put the bullseye on productive people. I hate to call them rich people, because some rich people have very low incomes, and I like to call them wealthy. So some wealthy people have very low incomes, and some very productive people don't have that much in savings. So it takes a while to build that savings. So they're trying to put a bullseye on people who are very productive and in high incomes. But that's a difficult thing to do, and so they have all these different rules. They're also trying to make it so that poor people don't pay taxes, but poor people don't understand any of these rules. And they don't understand the 16 different kinds of accounts, and they can't have a financial advisor who's helping them take advantage of that. And so having all of these different rules, I think, only hurts poor people, and it tries to punish productive people. And that seems to me to be hitting the two wrong ends of the spectrum. We should actually just try to make it simplified so that people could understand it better, and we should try to make it less onerous, which would mean let's just having something that's a more fair tax.
Before we go to the break, let's talk about the various distinctions of these accounts very quickly. What are the sorts of things we're going to look at in the next segment?
Yeah, so sometimes there's limits on when you can put money in, and sometimes there are limits on when you can take money out, and those are very important. Sometimes you put money in before taxes, and sometimes you put money in after taxes. Sometimes when you take the money out, it's taxed, and sometimes when you take the money out, it's not taxed. Sometimes in retirement, you have to take the money out and pay the tax, and that's a detriment. And sometimes when you die, your heirs have to take the money out all at once, and they could get hit with a very high tax bill. And all those combinations and permutations, including the multiple rules of when you can take the money out, are strewn across, you know, 20 or so different kinds of accounts.
It sounds very confusing. We're going to straighten everybody out on the other side. David Morata is our guest. We're talking about which retirement accounts to fund. It's very important if you like to keep your own money. Now, if you don't care, that's fine. You can just give it all away. But I think most people care, especially if they work for money. They care to keep it and to put it to its best use. 977-1070 is the phone number. We come back on the other side with more of David Morata and you. Stand by. It's The Shilling Show on 1070 WINA. Under the Milky Way tonight. Lower the curtain down. The Shilling Show continues here on a Monday edition of the program. Thanks for joining us. We're here weekdays from noon to 2 on 1070 WINA. Make an appointment with this program. Coming up in hour number 2, Brian Vanio for Albemarle County School Board in the Samuel Miller District, a constitutional conservative. And I think I heard him say, I'm going to have to paraphrase him, let's get the best education we can for the least amount of money. Bravo. Every school board member should be saying that. Anyway, Brian will be here with us in hour number 2. We continue now with David Morata, the president of Morata Wealth Management, and online at moradaonmoney.com. Which retirement accounts should you fund? Okay, so let's get into the very first category. Let's prioritize and start right at the top with those accounts that may have a match.
Yes, yeah, so the first one is you should always fund your 401k or your 403b if you have a match. And a match generally is when you put in 5% of your salary, the employer matches it with 4%. So it's an 80% return on your money, and it's immediate. And you can't beat the match. And even if your 401k has terrible offerings with high fees, it's probably still worth it to get 80% of the money. So 401ks sometimes have higher fees, and sometimes they're incredibly good. I remember when the client of ours, a small business owner, said, can you help us pick a 401k plan, and they brought us the 401k choices, and we said they're all terrible. And that was the point at which we started building our own 401k plan, which we called our dream 401k plan. And all it is low fees and expenses and lots of choices, and it has a Roth option. And so if your 401k plan has a Roth option, the Roth option is probably the right way to put your money in. The traditional money will get taxed later. And what we've seen, I'm going to sort of touch the first step is if you have a match. But I'm going to go to the other end and talk about why the other accounts, the two most common accounts, are not very tax efficient. One is a taxable account, and the taxable account takes advantage of none of the law, so it's subject to all of the capital gains and interest and dividends taxation. And so that's probably one of the least efficient ways to save for money. The traditional 401k is not necessarily a bad vehicle, but usually it's better to shelter it in some way where you've paid the tax up front and it doesn't build, because you can either pay a little bit of tax when you put the money in, or you can pay the huge growth when you've taken it out. And we've done a lot of Roth projections that we do, Roth versus traditional IRA projections that we do for clients. And what we found is that when you get a lot of money in a traditional 401k when you're young, then as it doubles and doubles, by the time you're in your late 70s and early 80s, you could be in the highest tax bracket simply with required minimum distributions. And so what we try to do is we try to make sure you don't overfund your 401k or your traditional IRAs, because if you do, then in your late 70s and early 80s, you're paying a tremendous amount of tax. And at that point, there's nothing you can do about it. So trying to do a tax equalization over your lifetime means paying some of the tax now and paying some of it later, and having the right balance between your Roth and your traditional accounts.
I want to talk about the employer match, because my goodness, if it's at 80% right off the bat, and I've never had the opportunity because I don't think I've ever worked full time in a situation where I could take advantage of something like that. But who wouldn't do it? Are there reasons that anybody wouldn't take advantage of such a thing? And do you have any idea what percentage of people actually capitalize on this?
Yes. It turns out that participation rates are not even near 100%. They're closer in the 70 or 80% range. Mm-hmm. And that's employers who are pushing it really hard. What they found is that people tend to do whatever the default is. And so more and more employers are getting smart, and they make the default automatically either funding it fully for the match, or they make it automatically increasing by 1% until it's fully funded for the match every year. And so they're trying to nudge participants in the right direction to be able to fully fund their Roth IRA. Now, if you are getting the match, so you're putting in 5% and your employer is matching with 4%, that means you're saving about 7% of your take-home pay. 9% of your take-home pay. So 5% from you and 4% from the employer. That's not enough to fully fund your retirement. You should be close to 15. So there's another 6% you should be putting in somewhere, and you should be funding it either in a Roth IRA or some other means. And so even if you're fully funding your match, you still haven't funded enough to be able to get a good retirement.
All right, so let's get into a little more of the details of the Roth and also the concept of the backdoor Roth.
Yeah, so a Roth IRA and a Roth 401k, you put the money in after tax, and then you don't never pay tax on it again. So it can grow to be millions of dollars in retirement, and those millions of dollars, you could take it out and spend it anytime you want. You know, all the growth within the Roth account continues to be tax-free, and so it's a very efficient vehicle. It's what investment would be without the burden of government upon it, and government allows you to do that. And so getting as much money into your Roth 401k and your Roth IRA is a great tax savings move. So on the Roth IRA, you can put in this year $5,500 each year, mm-hmm. And $6,500 if you're over 50, and you can do that for yourself and your spouse, even if your spouse doesn't work. You can do that even if you maybe don't have enough money. You need that money because you need that income to live off of. If you have any kind of taxable savings, you can simply put the money into the Roth and then take the money out of your taxable savings in order to live off of. And we call that funding your Roth IRA even when you can't afford it. Mm-hmm. And what you're doing is you're moving your taxable savings, where it's facing those headwinds, into the Roth, where it will never face the headwinds again. And that simply is converting your savings over by living off a piece of it. And that's a very efficient way to get money in. You can put money in even if all you're doing is saving for a house. So pretend like you're trying to save for a house and you put in $5,500 and your spouse puts in $5,500. You're putting in $11,000 every year to try to save for a house. Now, after a few years, you're taking $30,000 out for a house down payment. You can take whatever you put into your Roth, you can take out of your Roth. But all the growth while it's in there is not taxable, and all the growth gets to stay in there and never be taxed again. So it's a great savings vehicle, even if you're just trying to save for a house. In addition to what you put into the Roth IRA, you can take an extra $10,000 out if you're buying your first house. So you can even take $10,000 out of growth and not have to pay anything on it.
977-1070 is the phone number. It's 1243 here on The Shilling Show. We come back on the other side. I want to talk about HSAs, and you had a recent column that was terrific on the subject of when should you stop funding, if ever, your HSA. Stay tuned. David Morata continues here on The Shilling Show on the other side. Which retirement accounts should you fund? So for many years, I've had an HSA, and generally I've been happy with it, although I have a feeling that they're going to get harder to obtain in future years, as Obamacare, although they allow them, just makes it difficult for some of these policies to continue. And so let's talk to people about HSAs. It's been a great option for me personally. Tell us about the accounts, David.
Yeah, a health savings account is what an HSA is, and it has to be paired with a high deductible health insurance. It was the answer that was going to help health care before Obamacare ruined everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they're great options because you pay out of pocket, so it keeps health care costs down because you have an incentive to be able to negotiate for lower rates, and that was going to have an effect and was beginning to have an effect in some circles. And yet it still had disaster insurance, so that if you hit your $5,000 or $6,000 deductible, then everything was paid for. I still don't understand how people would have $10,000 or $20,000 bills when an HSA would limit those, you know, simply down to $5,000 deductibles. Mm-hmm. We seem to be in a worse situation now with all the Obamacare. Now everyone has higher $1,000 deductibles, and it costs more than the HSAs did. So it simply has ruined ruined healthcare. But an HSA is still a good idea, because especially if you're relatively well, because then you'll be paying less than $5,000 or $10,000 out of pocket, and you'll still be able to put in $5,000 or $6,000 each year. What it is you can put the money in pre-tax, so you're not taxed on it. And then when you take it out for any qualified health care expense, you're not taxed on it as well. So it's the only account, or one of the few accounts, where you can put money in pre-tax and you can take money out and not pay tax on it. The interesting thing about it is, rather than funding a long-term care insurance, it's better to, when you're young, simply fully fund your HSA. Because after putting in $5,000 a year, then you've got a nice big account. And if you have an account of somewhere between $75,000 and $250,000, you can self-fund your long-term care insurance. And if you do that from the time you're 50 until the time you're 75 or 85, when you normally a long-term care insurance, you need it for about 6 months when you're 85 years old. That's kind of the typical use. Mm-hmm. And yes, it's very expensive, and if you only have to fund it for 6 months, you could do that out of pocket easily. So fully funding your HSA is a way of replacing the long-term care insurance. In addition, after you turn 65, you can take money out of your HSA, even if it's not for qualified medical expenses. You do have to pay tax on it, so in that regard, it's like an IRA. But it's like an IRA that doesn't have required minimum distributions. So if you need the money, you can take it out. But if you don't need the money, you can leave it in, mm-hmm. and you don't get hit with that huge amount of money that you have to start taking required minimum distributions on at age 70, which is the amount that by age 80 could be pushing you into higher tax brackets. Now, there's one downside of an HSA, and that is when you die, your spouse can inherit it, and then it continues to be an HSA. But if both you and your spouse die and you leave it to someone else, they have to take the money out immediately, and it's immediately taxable. So if you've built up $250,000 because of your high deductible health insurance, and then you die and your wife dies and you leave it to your children, they will get hit in 1 year with $250,000 worth of income. Now, I don't think your kids are going to complain, oh, gee, mom and dad left me $250,000. Mm-hmm. I have to pay tax on it. But I do think that is a less estate planning tax shelter than, say, a Roth account, where you can leave them in a tax-free income stream for life.
Is there any mitigation strategy for that particular instance?
The biggest thing is to always take money out for your healthcare expenses, because anytime you can take it out for your healthcare expenses, you're getting money out and not paying tax on it, and you're keeping the account relatively small. So I would just simply pay for all of your medical expenses out of it. If it does continue to grow, and it's up at the $250,000 range, I think leaving there for your long-term care insurance, because usually the care that you need is expensive, and it's in the last 6 months of life. So if you simply hang on for longer than 6 months, you can start actually depleting that account, and you'll be helping your heirs out because they won't be taxed on it. But I think the longer you live, the better that HSA account becomes, because it continues to grow tax-free and it continues to be an insurance against those medical expenses.
Finally, let's talk about other types of accounts. I know there are 529 education savings accounts. Are there others people should consider?
Yeah. Your Roth 401k, you can fund up to $18,000 a year. Mm-hmm. And if you're over 50, there's a $6,000 catch-up, meaning you can fund it for $24,000
wow.
a year. That's a lot of money to put in. In addition to that, you can also put the $5,500 into the Roth. And if you and your spouse are both on a 401k, then you can obviously put in a lot of money, over $50,000 into Roth accounts every single year. That's an amazing way to get a tremendous amount of money into Roth accounts where it will never be taxed again. If you do any kind of self-employment, so a speaking engagement or consulting, a SEP IRA, you can put 25% of all of your income away tax sheltered. And that's good because with your speaking fees, you can then delay that until later when you can take it out in a lower tax bracket. So all of the traditional accounts are trying to do is to lower your tax while it's high and increase it when it's low. And there's a period of years when your income is liable to be very low. And that's usually for most people between the day you retire and age 70 when you have to start taking out required minimum distributions. So that's usually like from 65 until 70 or from 62 until 70, or if you retire young, maybe even from 50 until 70. And being able to convert all of that income that you've deferred into Roth accounts during those gap years means you're able to convert it in the lowest tax brackets possible because you have absolutely no income during those gap years. And that's another sort of strategy to help lower your tax burden over your entire lifetime. And so you may be contributing to your Roth accounts to keep your taxes lower later. The match is going to be coming in with traditional, but then you're going to be converting that traditional during the gap years. The SEP IRA will be lowering people in very high income brackets, and then you'll convert some of that during the SEP years. And then you'll take some of that out in required minimum distributions, but just enough, y'all have lowered it enough to be just enough to keep you in the lower tax brackets. And so that's the way the game is played, and those are the dance moves that you're trying to put in place to be able to keep the government from taking too much.
David Morata's got a lot of information on all of these things in great detail, a number of columns that he's written. They're accessible to you online at moratonmoney.com. And any hopes in our remaining 30 seconds, any hopes that this is going to become any simpler if we had a regime change in this country?
Well, I've always thought one of the simplest taxes is simply either a tax on imports or a head tax where you tax everyone the same and you cut it off at a certain limit. Or
the tax, not the head.
Yeah, exactly. Yep. Right now they tend to cut off the head anyone who sticks up too high. Or simply a consumption tax and a sales tax of some kind of a fair tax because rich people spend more, but then you don't deter savings. And I just think with savings being the most important thing for people's future selves to be happy, we should do everything we can to, like the 401k employers, to nudge people in the right direction of savings. And the way the government could do that is simply by not taxing capital gains, not taxing savings, and then we wouldn't need all of these crazy kinds of accounts.
They are crazy, but I'm so glad that we help people figure it out today and get them on the right path. David Morata, thanks as always for joining us on The Shilling Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, that's going to wrap this hour of a Monday edition of The Shilling Show. We come back on the other side. It's open phones for you. Would love to hear from you, whatever is on your mind. It's 977-1070. Ian stands by to take your calls politely and professionally, 434-977-1070. You can send me an email, robs@wina.com, and you can get in line right now. It's 977-1070. Big second hour straight ahead. Well, 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 well.